Columbia Circuit. Our minds to draw near and give their attention to the courts now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Case number 10-534, voting in the
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Catherine Hancock on behalf of defendants appellants. The Supreme Court's decision in Reichel compels the conclusion here that defendants appellants are entitled to qualified immunity. In Reichel, the Supreme Court held that the arresting officers were entitled to qualified immunity on a retaliatory arrest claim for a probable cause-based arrest. The Supreme Court held that qualified immunity was applicable even though it was unclear whether Hartman's requirement of an absence of probable cause is necessary to establish a First Amendment violation as opposed to a damages remedy, and second, that it is unclear whether Hartman even applies to retaliatory arrest cases.
I get the point about it compels our non-reinstatement of Moore 5. I don't know why it compels the outcome on the arguable probable cause question.
Well, it compels, I think, the conclusion that this court would have to determine whether there was arguable probable cause. And we've gone through the evidence, and I'd be happy to go through it again, that there is arguable probable cause in this case. The Supreme Court's cases have made clear that if you are looking
at... But they're two separate questions. That's all I'm trying to be clear about.
In terms...
You said Reichel compels qualified immunity here.
And Your Honor, I think it does.
If we accept your version of the facts. Reichel doesn't speak to that.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. It doesn't speak to the facts here. The court would have to determine whether there was, in fact, arguable probable cause, which we think the evidence laid out in this case is clear. And it's not, in determining arguable probable cause, of course, this court needs to look at the facts and the evidence and then draw the inferences in the favor of the inspectors who had that evidence before them to determine whether there's arguable probable cause. And on the record here, we think that that is clearly sufficient to show arguable probable cause.
So is the government's position, hypothetically, that if Waite, the Supreme Court case, and our decision in Haynesworth had discussed probable cause, then there would be no entitlement to qualified immunity?
That would be a much closer question, Your Honor, but even in terms of, in light of Reichel, that indicates that the law was not clearly established.
Well,
in
I'm
terms
getting
of,
to your point that suggested in one of the supplemental briefs you filed that the Supreme Court had questioned whether clearly established circuit law at the time of the action by the law enforcement officer could in fact constitute sufficiently well-established law.
Correct. Because Reichel, for instance, had a Tenth Circuit case directly on point where it had held that a retaliatory arrest supported by probable cause could violate the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court held that defendants were entitled to qualified immunity nonetheless.
Well, I understand because the Supreme Court was focusing on something a little different. My hypothetical was the circuit has clearly focused on exactly what the Supreme Court was addressing in Reichel back in, 1986, 87. And these actions took place in 1988.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think
that... In other words, I'm just suggesting, I'm not sure I read our decision in Boehm to go quite as far as you suggest.
Well, I think Boehm clearly states that if you can look to if the law was not clearly established, you can look to later cases to after the defendant's actions to determine to support the fact that the it was not.
The circuit had not ruled on the question.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I think it's a closer question if Waite and Haynesworth had actually discussed probable cause, but they didn't. And I think even so, Reichel would create some uncertainty whether defendants here would still be entitled to qualified immunity, since that was a Supreme Court case questioning that. The fact that the arresting officers in Reichel were afforded qualified immunity makes clear that the law is sufficiently unclear that
the plaintiffs argue that since there was probable cause in that case, the court really didn't have to resolve this question because either way, case would have come out the same, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat the question?
I think there was probable cause in Reichel.
Yes, there was probable cause.
Yeah. So the plaintiffs argue in their brief that that the court really didn't have to resolve this question because whether Hartman imposed a new requirement on the element of the crime or whether it was just a requirement of proof wouldn't have made any difference initially.
But I don't think that's correct, Your Honor, because
that's why I asked you what you thought about the plaintiff's argument.
Because in terms of, I mean, for clearly established law, we presume there's a constitutional violation, which the question of whether there's an absence of probable cause would go to whether there's a constitutional violation. So for purposes here and in Reichel, you would have presumed there was probable cause, and that doesn't answer the clearly established question. And for that, again, Reichel makes here in Reichel, it was unclear whether Hartman's requirement, no probable cause, applied to a retaliatory arrest case. But it's clear that Hartman's requirement of absence of probable cause applies here in this very case, and because it's a retaliatory prosecution case, which is what Hartman was all about. So there's less uncertainty in this case than there was in Reichel because Hartman clearly applies here. And so if in Reichel they held that the defendant officers were entitled to qualified immunity, then the defendant officers here were certainly entitled to qualified immunity because the law was also unclearly established. Did that answer your question, Your Honor?
I'm not sure.
The arguable probable cause here, the Supreme Court's cases in Anderson and Saucier have made it clear that if there's a probable cause question for clearly established law, the defendant officers are also entitled to qualified immunity when they reasonably but mistakenly believe they have probable cause. The reasonable but mistaken beliefs the Supreme Court has held have applied across the board, not just in a Fourth Amendment context.
Would you agree that your statement of the facts is somewhat sanitized?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't.
Well, what about the threats? What about all the evidence and all the other co-conspirators exonerating the plaintiff? I mean, you don't talk about that at all.
No, Your Honor, and the reason we don't is because when you view arguable probable cause,
Anderson, it talks about the officer is entitled to summary judgment on grounds of qualified immunity if he can establish that he reasonably believed that what he was doing was not a violation of a constitutional right, even if he was wrong in fact.
Correct.
So, do you agree that this court is to decide the question?
Of arguable probable cause? Yes, we do, Your Honor. And even if there was evidence clearly from the record that some of the co-conspirators denied or suggested that Moore did not know of the conspiracy, there was certainly other evidence that the inspectors could have reasonably relied on here to conclude that that they reasonably believed that there was probable cause to prosecute more.
What is the relevance of the district court's findings in denying summary judgment?
The district court never even reached the arguable probable cause question.
But it made findings in denying summary judgment.
It made some limited findings, but I don't think, again, in light of Reichel, I don't think those are applicable here in terms of the qualified immunity question. It didn't make findings on the arguable probable. The district court did not make
but
findings
the
on the arguable probable cause.
The district court had made a
cause.
Finding that the postal inspector's view was inherently incredible.
Well, unless it was clearly erroneous, I would think the district court's findings would stand, but
So they are relevant.
Except that the court didn't make any findings.
Here's my hypothetical, though. He didn't rule, and therefore I find no qualified immunity. But he made findings of fact that are relevant to would a reasonable officer having this information reasonably conclude?
I don't think that he did, Your Honor, because he talked about, I believe there was discussion in terms of the indictment and whether there was the rebuttable presumption created by the indictment and evidence before the grand jury, but evidence, if he thought there was evidence that tainted the indictment, that's wholly separate from whether the inspectors had a body of evidence that would support probable cause.
I'll cite you to the district court opinion at page 593, 94, etc. I mean, we don't have to go through this here. I don't think it would be particularly productive, but he did make relevant findings, it seems to me.
If I think, I'm looking at footnote 6. If I think that Moore 5 is a proper interpretation of Hartman, okay, if I think that that's right, if I think that's the best reading of Hartman, that is that it's not an element of the tort, but rather a requirement of proof, what precisely is it in this footnote that requires us to change Moore 5?
Because
what
Reichel,
precisely in it? What is it?
Because Reichel establishes that it is unclear whether the absence of probable cause is a requirement of the First Amendment violation
or the damages remedy. In the arrest context.
In the arrest context, right. That's right, Your Honor. But Reichel.
Intuition tells me there's something different about a.
But Reichel also noted that retaliatory arrest cases and retaliatory prosecution cases have been treated the same, and so officers could have reasonably relied on that fact, and so the officers here, it's the same. They could have reasonably relied on retaliatory arrest cases that treat the retaliatory arrest cases, which have looked to arguable probable cause. So I think when you combine those two parts together, Reichel makes clear that defendants here would still be entitled to qualified immunity, even if this court were to be of the opinion that it is just a absence of probable cause is better read as part of the damages remedy and not a First Amendment violation.
If we can't figure this out, why shouldn't we just reinstate our decision and everybody can go back to the Supreme Court and find out what all this means?
Well, Your Honor, I'd argue that if this court can't figure it out, then that surely means the defendant officers here, how could they have possibly figured it out? And
well,
they should be entitled to qualified immunity.
That's not the question.
Well, but I mean, I think it is here back for the court to decide, and that although Reichel may be dissatisfying in that it's not completely clear, again, I think that unclarity establishes that the law was not clearly established and that this court can look to whether there is arguable probable cause and determine whether the defendants are entitled to qualified
immunity. So by saying it's an open question, that shows it's not clearly established.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions, we would ask this court to reverse the judgment of the district court and enter judgment for defendants.
Thank you. Morning.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Paul Michael Pohl, counsel for Appellee William G. Moore. This is the sixth time in the 21-year history of this case that it's been my pleasure to appear before the court. The case, as I said, is 21 years old, and as Judge Henderson observed at our last appearance here, I think 20 judges at three levels of the U.S. court system have reviewed this case, and nobody has ever suggested that it should be tossed out on immunity, qualified immunity, or arguable probable cause. As Judge Tatel recited very well in Moore 3, and is again referenced in the unanimous panel opinion in 2011, there are dramatic facts here of retaliation. The first reason to indict was that Mr. Moore had been a harsh critic of Postal Service management to media and in Congress. There are more than one documents on that that are called smoking guns in a prior opinion of this court. And also we have a well-developed record that shows even the postal inspectors had concluded that Mr. Moore individually did not know about the conspiracy. If this kind of case with a developed record and this evidence can't get to trial, then Bivens really becomes illusory. It's been chewed to death by immunity arguments. We know we're here on a GVR. That's not a reversal or invitation to reverse. Nor is it an invitation to get reconsideration or re-argue points that were lost before by one party. My position is very simple. The prior panel opinion got it exactly right in 2011.
What about the footnote 6 point that counsel raised, that the Supreme Court indicated that it's uncertain whether it's an element of the tort or related to recovery, and that shows that it could not be clearly established? I think I'm stating their position.
That's how I understand the position, Your Honor. Just because the court in Reichel didn't need to decide that question doesn't mean that there was uncertainty at the law at the time the actors acted.
Well, the unanimous, it'd be unusual. I'll let you finish, yeah. But just it'd be unusual for the Supreme Court to say in the way they did that this is an open question. We need not resolve is what the precise words were if it were already clear. It's not how they usually do it.
Well, the decision in Hartman versus Moore, as we know by the Supreme Court, in which Judge Souter said, by the way, it is settled law that you can't have retaliation for First Amendment expression, following what this court had said in Haynesworth and the U.S. Supreme Court said in Waite, that part's settled law. Whether someone can read the Supreme Court's decision in Hartman versus Moore as treating probable cause as part of a First Amendment right, which was violated, as opposed to the Fourth Amendment, which includes the words probable cause, that hasn't been decided by the U.S. Supreme Court yet. That was the issue that the panel decided unanimously in 2011, and I submit the unanimous panel, in the opinion authored by Judge Henderson, got it exactly right. To do what the government is inviting you to do here would upset radically upset.
Well, before, that's the point at which you need to answer Judge Kavanaugh's question. Yeah. So you say Moore 5 got it just right. Then what's the implication of this sentence that we need not decide that question? They are saying, the Supreme Court is saying they're not deciding the question Moore 5 decided.
That's correct. And just because a question right. is raised by creative lawyering that is left unanswered doesn't mean that the panel's decision shouldn't
still
stand.
Correct.
They didn't need to raise it.
Yeah.
And merely because that hasn't
who
yet...
Who's the they?
the U.S. Supreme Court in that footnote. Uh-huh. But
That because it's in a footnote?
No, I think
Haynesworth. You know that because there was probable cause in this case.
Well, in this case, we know now part of our burden.
I don't mean Moore. I mean the okay. Secret Service case.
Reischl.
In Reischl, there was probable cause. It was an arrest case. And especially when you get to arguable probable cause, this is a retaliatory inducement to prosecute case. As the panel opinion showed in 2011, probable cause may be part of the Fourth Amendment right. Indeed, the words are in the Fourth Amendment. But in the retaliatory inducement to prosecute case, our case, probable cause, absence of probable cause is how you prove causation. It is not part of the First Amendment right that was violated. That's why I'm saying
question, right? That's the Supreme Court says, then goes on, it suffices for qualified immunity purposes that the answer would not have been clear to a reasonable official when Howard was arrested. Now, that's talking about the facts there, but it's following the sentence we just read. It does sound like the Supreme Court saying, and it's a footnote, and we could say it's a throwaway, but it does sound like they're saying there's sufficient uncertainty about the point you just said that they're going to leave it open for now.
Well, that there may be uncertainty. I think the way you analyze these cases are probable cause is part of the right in Fourth Amendment cases.
Right.
Probable cause is not in First Amendment cases. You can enjoin a First Amendment violation, a continuing violation.
But isn't that isn't that the question the Supreme Court said they're not going to resolve?
It was important for them to resolve it in a Fourth Amendment case with probable cause and an allegation of First Amendment violation.
You need not resolve whether Hartman is best read as defining the scope of the First Amendment right or as simply establishing a prerequisite for recovery.
In that case, they did not resolve it, but that does not mean there was uncertainty about the relevant law here at the time of the action. The law in Waite, Haynesworth, in earlier opinions in Moore, and I suggest in Justice Souter's opinion in Hartman, is that the relevant point of law, that you cannot retaliate against someone for the exercise of their First Amendment rights, that is settled law, and that's the point that's critical in this case. Whether in an arrest context somebody can think of something that isn't settled that benefits a probable cause arrest with a First Amendment violation, that's a different point of law.
Well, then Ms. Hancock's follow-up point, I think, point two, was retaliatory arrest and prosecution cases are similar or the same, so the Supreme Court says in Reischl. So that was how, I think that was the two-part.
I think what Ms. Hancock left out of her paraphrase was, if you look at immunity cases, sometimes First Amendment cases look at Fourth Amendment cases and vice versa. It doesn't say they're the same. In fact, for immunity purposes, they're not the same. That's our point on Anderson versus Creighton. It's never been applied in a First Amendment retaliatory prosecution case. Anderson versus Creighton has been limited to Fourth Amendment cases where there are exigent circumstances. In that case, you know, they kicked the door down and went in, and the robber wasn't in the house. And there's discussion about whether absence of probable cause makes the action necessarily unreasonable. What the government's trying to do here is drag what I'll call the expanded zone of immunity for reasonable mistakes in, for the first time ever, into a retaliatory inducement to prosecute case. And I think Justice Scalia's comments in the recent Al Kidd case is relevant here, so that we don't get tangled up in reasonable but mistaken or arguable probable cause. Justice Scalia said, qualified immunity gives government officials breathing room to make reasonable but mistaken judgments about open legal questions. The legal question at the heart of this case, Moore versus Hartman, is whether you can take coercive and punitive action against someone who's exercised First Amendment rights. That is still settled law. It's been settled since Waite. Three times this court called it settled, and I said Justice Souter called it settled. That's why the first leap they've got you to make is to reverse all those cases and say the law isn't settled as to the point relevant here. Second, the Bain case makes clear in the majority opinion and in the dissent that you look at the law at the time the actors acted. Judge Rogers said eloquently in Bain, because constitutional rights are at risk, the Supreme Court has required the focus of a reasonably competent public official be on the law as it was clearly established at the time of his conduct and not on his subjective hope that the then settled legal consensus may change. What is alarming, so you'd have to say the law wasn't settled as to retaliatory acts for First Amendment rights. You'd have to change the time, you'd have to throw Bain out the window. And then you'd, for the first time, you'd have to drag reasonable but mistaken into this arena where it's never been brought. What is really disturbing about the government's position is stated at page 8 of the government's brief. It says, an official in defendant's position could have reasonably believed in 1988 that this court's extension of Waite was wrong. That is horrible policy. That's a horrible argument. That is saying that a law enforcement officer who sees a clear circuit ruling about not retaliating can choose to ignore it.
But on your disturbing, alarming discussion, yeah, isn't what happened in Reichel disturbing and alarming? In other words, you have probable cause to arrest someone, but you probably wouldn't. Even though you have probable cause, but you don't like the speech that the person uttered.
And so
you're going to arrest the person when you wouldn't have. And the Supreme Court says qualified immunity.
Well,
there's probable cause. I mean, that's pretty disturbing too, isn't it?
Well, Reichel, once again, is I characterize it, unlike this case, it's a primarily a Fourth Amendment case. Where there was,
I
understand
by the law, just on the disturbing, alarming, you've thrown those words around, and I think I'm not criticizing your use of those terms.
Yeah,
I'm just saying
what
was the Supreme Court faced in Reichel seems disturbing, alarming too. But lots of times officers have probable cause to arrest, and if they choose to make the arrest when they don't like the political speech that's being uttered, and they choose not to make the arrest otherwise, that's alarming and disturbing. And the Supreme Court still says, you're out of luck.
Well, I read all the cases, the arrest and Fourth Amendment cases, especially with executive protection. The officers get a broad zone of immunity, as they should. In Reichel, it was undisputed that the defendant touched or pushed the vice president. There was an allegation, the First Amendment, but I think the probable cause there and the absence of clear facts developed in the record that there was legitimate evidence that could go to a jury of retaliatory intent.
But the Supreme Court's rule applies even if there is a
probable cause. In a Fourth Amendment case, you win if there's probable cause.
Yeah, even if there's a mountain of evidence that you made the arrest because you didn't like the political speech.
That's the Fourth Amendment cases.
Yeah.
And that's why I say the law has evolved now to where you don't treat Fourth and First the same. The amendments of the Constitution are different. You don't want to engraft into the First Amendment, but it depends on whether there's probable cause or not. And analytically, Anderson versus Creighton has never been applied in this kind of setting.
I agree with your clarity, or I might agree with the clarity, but then the Supreme Court seems to, I guess we're back to footnote 6. We're just going to figure out what footnote 6 is.
That's true. But
yeah,
once
so why don't you just say once more, as crisply as you can, what your answer is to the question about the implications of this sentence for our case?
Well,
that the answer would not have been clear. It suffices for qualified immunity purposes that the answer would not have been clear to a reasonable official.
The answer is, until this footnote appeared in 2011, there was no doubt that on the relevant point of law, it's been settled.
Okay, what's the implications of the footnote? That's the question.
Well, the footnote is, if there's any uncertainty, the uncertainty has arisen now, and I would say it only arises on the arrest side of the case. It's not in retaliatory inducement to prosecute because there's no exigent circumstances. And analytically, the cases are now going down two tracks. One is the exigent circumstances cases where they give you the benefit of reasonable but mistaken, depending on the facts, and the First Amendment retaliatory inducement to prosecute cases where Anderson versus Creighton has never crept in, and until this footnote, nobody ever said there was uncertainty about, you know, as I said, Wade and Haynesworth and the earlier opinions and more. This is what these qualified immunity cases have become. Clever lawyers think of a difference in the facts or something else, and they raise an issue, and if it doesn't need to be decided, they say, well, we've got uncertainty. We don't have uncertainty, or we shouldn't have uncertainty, on the critical points upon which the prior panel opinion rests here.
Let me ask you this. In Bain, the court, the majority said that, you know, qualified immunity is a one-way ratchet. And the theory is that we don't want officers who took reasonable action, you know, to face potential liability. So in that sense, does that have any implication for this footnote? I mean, the dissent took the position that the majority did not accept that, you know, if the law is clear at the time the officer acts, even though that's where the Supreme Court had been in the cases cited by the dissent. So the majority says it's a one-way ratchet. And here now we have, in 1988, the law in this circuit is arguably clear. And later, the Supreme Court drops this footnote, admittedly in a Fourth Amendment case. So your point is basically what Judge Tatel's question suggested, we just charge ahead and let the Supreme Court figure this out?
They didn't need to reach the point, and just because they didn't doesn't mean there's uncertainty on the critical point, but reinstate the panel opinion because analytically, it's right on. If the Supreme Court chooses to correct it, that might happen. But
which they denied cert then.
Well, what don't we all? But what?
I mean, that's a somewhat serious point too. They obviously did GVR, and that's not done lightly.
Yeah.
Because they saw something.
Well, in the government cert petition, it said that if Reichel decides whether absence of probable cause is part of your First Amendment right, then that really would undercut it. I'd be making a different argument here if I was here at all. But just because they don't decide an issue they didn't need to decide doesn't mean there's uncertainty back in 1988 or that you got it wrong in the 20 years since then. That's why, you know, at bottom, I think they may well have read the opinion, this is wild speculation, and decided that's the right facts to sort it out in the First Amendment context. Let's see where that goes. But the other invitation you're being issued here to do something that you shouldn't, that I think would be unprecedented, is in a retaliatory inducement to prosecute case where arguably you don't have jurisdiction under Ashcroft versus Iqbal to reweigh facts, is to grab on to a couple of snippets that are trotted out in sanitized fashion and declare the defendants the winner. We're just starting to hear this arguable but mistaken, arguable probable cause. I'm not sure whether they're conceding now they didn't have probable cause and they have to do that it was reasonable but mistaken, which has never been applied in this context. But that's something new. It turns on facts, and as the prior panel opinion said here, you have jurisdiction on interlocutory appeals to decide neat, abstract questions of law. Wading into a fact record like this, where the district court has already decided there's enough to survive summary judgment, is not, I suggest respectfully, what this court should be doing. The cases where an appellate court has looked at the facts and declared somebody a winner on either qualified immunity or arguable probable cause have been limited to either facts that were undisputed, undisputable, or resolving in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, you could still find qualified immunity. That certainly isn't the record before the court today. So,
if we disagree with you on the law, are you asking then for a remand on the determination of whether there was arguable probable cause? I might be missing the import of what you just said.
Well, there's different things you could disagree with me on the law. If you say the law wasn't settled
right.
in 1988,
right.
and I don't see that that's legitimately in front of the court.
Suppose that's what we said, then what do you want us to do? What would you
Well, if the law wasn't settled in 1988 as to the critical issue in this case, my case is in trouble. Mm-hmm. But if something happens in a Fourth Amendment case in 2011, you have to throw out BAME, where both the majority and the dissent agreed on the relevant time is the time of the action. And I'm arguing it has to be, because that invites law enforcement officers to disregard the law in the hope that it's going to change.
Let me just ask you a little bit about your concession there. When I was questioning counsel for the government, I basically paraphrased Anderson. So Anderson states the proposition as a question of law that the officer has to demonstrate. That's not sort of an Iqbal factual analysis.
I suggest that Anderson was decided on undisputed facts.
I see.
It was admitted by everyone. They thought the bank robber Dixon was in the house. They kicked the door in. He wasn't there. And as the court will recall, in the Fourth Amendment discussion, it talked about exigent circumstances. Sometimes you need to make a snap decision. Mm-hmm. None of that applies here, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't think you drag Anderson versus Creighton into this. Mm-hmm. We had senior people who were postal inspectors working a mile from the court where Haynesworth was decided. They had, in this kind of case, the department, they had their own counsel at the Postal Service, they had the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office. There were no snap decisions here. They really went through all these really reprehensible tactics to get an indictment because they wanted to knock this company out of the postal procurement. The indictment was their reward. That's why they got bonuses and promoted and made instructors. But I go back to the you'd have to upset the law as to what's been called settled for 20 years. You'd have to change BAME. You'd have to, for the first time, drag Anderson versus Creighton in this context. And you'd have to be weighing facts that you shouldn't be weighing in order to do what the government wants. None of this is appropriate on a GVR because it's an attempt basically to re-argue or move for reconsideration the way it's the government would posture it. So, once again, I thank you for your attention. If you have any further questions, I'll be happy to answer them. But obviously, we just think the prior panel opinion had the issues clearly defined. It made good analyses as to jurisdiction, as to where it shouldn't be weighing facts, as to the First Amendment point being just a causation issue, not a part of the constitutional right. And it was looking at the law at the time the actors acted.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel for appellant, give you a couple of minutes.
Just a few points, Your Honors. First, in response to opposing counsel's comment about that there's a dispute about the facts and the court wouldn't really have jurisdiction here to go into the facts. On arguable probable cause, there's not a dispute about the facts. The facts are all laid out in our briefs on the earlier appeal here. It's really just a question of the possible inferences that the inspectors could have drawn from that evidence and whether they could have reasonably found probable cause on that. That is a legal question that this court can clearly decide. And in terms of opposing counsel also emphasize that the principle that retaliation for First Amendment expression is unconstitutional has been clearly established. We don't dispute that. That is a general principle, and the Supreme Court has made clear that you have to look to the particular particularized right in question in qualified immunity, which in this case is retaliation for First Amendment expression, where the retaliation, the prosecution was supported by probable cause. Reischel also rejected that the general principle here, the question about just retaliation for First Amendment was not applicable.
I guess I don't understand what you're telling us.
Just that the general principle of retaliation for First Amendment speech is not specific enough here. That's not the question for qualified immunity to determine whether it's clearly established or not. Rather, it's whether retaliation for First Amendment speech where the prosecution was also supported by probable cause. That is the question that this court has to look to.
Well, no, that's only if you're correct.
Yeah.
I mean, that you're assuming a conclusion.
Well, I think that's clear from
if you're right,
Reischel's import.
Well, if you're right about Reischel, that's right. But if your interpretation of Reischel is not right, then is not correct, then we do look at it at the more generalized level.
Well, but Reischel specifically rejected that the plaintiff's argument in that case that the court should just be looking at retaliation for First Amendment expression as opposed to a retaliatory arrest based on probable cause and whether that violated the First Amendment. So I think that is...
In the arrest context,
that is clear. And then Reischel also discussed how there was the legal backdrop that the arrest case has been treated the same as retaliatory prosecution cases.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything further?
No, that's it, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement. We'll take a short recess.